Okay. I imagine DG is just outside communicating with me. So we were meant to ask neighbors no. As member no. Yeah, the minister brief us a little bit she's being newly appointed to town. And then we were gonna go straight into the annual report presentation by the department. But I think we can skip that first part and everything that's happening. Like, have agreement of all of one of you.
Apologies for the late, apologies for the late submission of the annual report. We know that the report happens a week in advance, so I'm not sure when I think it's been discussing about whether we have a department or not. I think unfortunately we come to a moment that they have responsibilities that are due, but they appear coming off the time they come to a point of So let me start with the Eskom thing, and then everyone will then come through the Eskom presentation. In the budget speech, Minister of Finance, when he indicated 60 million, and then subsequently when we did the application for the 60 million, and when we subsequently did the application for the recapitalization, tariff increase for Eskom, and the decision came out when we got less than what we had anticipated. If you recall that the initial decision had been 60 billion over a 5-year period, and in fact it was not 60 billion over the cash, part of the 60 billion was going to be in the form of guarantees. Post the application, it became then important that an urgent that government actually fast track the injection into Eskom, but also make it all cash into Eskom. And especially after the subsequent downgrading of Eskom, it became important. Now, we needed an instrument that would be treated as equity, so in a sense, this subordinated loan is in effect that kind of instrument. It becomes a quasi instrument, equity instrument, which was better realized, so which is long enough a period to be treated as equity, so that when they look at Eskom's debt equity ratio, it adjusts, it changes, it reduces the debt equity ratio of Eskom, and should enable them to continue the borrowing program. But I say should because that's not necessarily the complete plug of Eskom. So effectively, as the Treasury, because this is unlike a regular adjustment, which is a one-off adjustment that would happen at the end of the year, it in effect almost, it is a 3-year allocation, so that the money would just flow to Eskom and a decision is made once and for all. And for that reason, the state guidance for an official bill of funds that would then allow the money to come into Eskom in the council of 10, 20, and 30 billion over the next 3 years, beginning this year with an assembly in the I don't think it's basically that doesn't say much more. The shareholder loan conditions, I think it actually would be very crucial that in a closed session with the committee, we have a greater discussion about that with yourself, because some of the conditions that attach could be material. We've prepared a presentation as usual. I'll cover only the summary, so to speak, and the rest of the various managers and the leaders will cover the areas that they have responsibility for. The presentation covers the area of performance over the last couple of years, just a brief synopsis of the DPE organizational structure, DPE specific performance review by all of the programs, and that's when all of the various teams will go to that. And I might as well introduce it now. Shireen Costin was the corporate head of corporate services, will cover the whole administration unit. Then there's Pashani is going to be talking, Ursula has gone to Rakhisbaum, an area where clearly one of the things that we're trying to do today actually is do a more induction of the new board members of the LISCO as well. So Ursula's not here, so Pashani will do the legal induction in confession. Chris Foley will run with the energy and board planning, so he'll be specifically responsible for that area. And then Kelly is going to talk to the joint project facility. Adam, he that is sitting in for Andrew, and so he will cover the transport. John Morris will cover the manufacturing portfolio. In the last financial year, so it is always the thing about DPE, there's so much happens in the year that by the time you come to the end of the year and you look back, and it's like it's so far in some ways, and so much has changed in the beginning, which I suppose is a little comfortable that there is progress. But in the last financial year, we did complete the shareholder, the government shareholder management model, the draft thereof. It's draft having been approved inside the department, because if you recall, when it got to the point and whether we would go ahead at that time with the legislation or not, it was then in that discussion of reviewing both the TFM vote as well as the GFM that the decision was made for a comprehensive review of governance with respect to state owned enterprises. But a lot of the work has been done, and so all we are doing now is given some of the recommendations that we'd like to make around how governance of large or strategic employees is undertaken, is then to develop a space framework for all other employees. So that was done, and that should be probably not completed in this financial year, but rather look that we will complete properly in the next financial year. And we actually still do need to have quite a lot of discussions with the portfolio committee on the various elements of the government shareholder management model. However, in the last year as well, we had the enactment of board members for as well as the FXF. FXF, unfortunately, we've concluded on the terms of the transaction between ourselves and Transnet, and they are small last condition of business that we need to close on before that can be a standalone FOU for the community. But the Scott settlement, that was then finally concluded in the last year, and then the implementation has included no gap. The competitive supply development program was approved by Cabinet Office as the framework that would guide procurement by state-owned enterprises, which have long been approved. The framework is actually quite critical to make real any ambition of using the investment program and the growth program of the SOE to leverage an industrial development component. So that's been approved, and in the next financial year, and I suppose given the time issues that the committee has, it would be quite nice to win the ESCOM one, which has been approved, the Transnet Competitive Supply Development Program, which has been approved, and as you'll recall, the approvals are concurrent to approvals between the Minister of Trade and Industry and the Minister of Public Enterprises. We are just in the final stages of approving the Competitive Supply Development Program that's attached to PDR. The Transition Fund Act, Amendment Act, was promulgated last year. Also, there was that emergency recap of SA last year, quite a bit of success given generally the sentiment that we have to deal with, which we have to say that SA has actually pursued good news. it's operationally it's done much better. But unfortunately, the environment in which they operate, where oil prices have shot up, that really becomes a real problem. In the next couple of months, with the rate at the level at which it's at, we should be seeing more so, unfortunately, some of those effects feeding you know, the issue of the financial markets is a real problem for ESCOM as well as Transnet as well, who have to borrow globally. We'll have to watch and see how their borrowing program, if they are successful. Shareholders' contract for ESCOM for now, if there is that the first time that we had quite a broad cycle from shareholder contracts by SOE. By DPE. Obviously, TDMR is not quite, we still have to figure out what's the modality of signing of a shareholder agreement with TDMR when we're not the 100% shareholder, how we negotiate that with the other shareholders. And as you know, if TDMR is actually an unincorporated JV under ESCOM, so it's just a subsidiary of ESCOM. In the last year as well, we had the Employment and Skills Development Agency approved. For that, we required the Department of Labor to approve us as an ESDA. And what an ESDA does is enable a consolidation or coordination of skills development in a sector. And the sector that we are looking at first is the energy sector, where we are working not only with ESCOM, but we're also working with all of the suppliers of ESCOM to put together a joint skills development program. So that enables a application for us to use the South African term of skills programs which are broader than just what the capacities of the employees are. In as far as the emergency, National Electricity Emergency Response Plan, this beginning of this year was our time, and that we started off the year with the electricity emergency, and that actually really did take quite a lot of time, energy, and effort. But I do think in the end we were able to deal fairly well with a really tough problem, and which was the first problem in society's history that actually we had had a situation of that kind. I think, you know, by the end of this year we should write a report on what we've learned so that we can, in future, going forward, we can ensure that at the very least for the next generation who will be in government and in ESCOM, some of the lessons that we take away, and a lot of the lessons that we take away, we will be coming back with some proposals on how we deal with pricing of electricity and the rest of the lines, but not only just electricity, but also other utilities, because it has relevance for other utilities as well. And then departmentally, and this is something that we'll probably report on in the next financial year, is that as part of the, as our support, I suppose, and our responsibility in reducing, becoming more energy efficient, we did implement a program which actually has been quite successful, and we measure on a monthly basis how we've been doing in that area. Just briefly, the organogram of the department, nothing much changed, save for the fact that we created a position of CDG, Chief Investment and Portfolio Manager, which has been quite useful in that for the first time, I think we've had three or four board meetings at CDG, where we are able to have a comprehensive discussion about the portfolio and look at the whole portfolio's risks and look at how the whole portfolio is performing, and also do an assessment of where are the opportunities, where the risks, the general risks that we see in the whole portfolio. And I mean, it's important. What are the key risks that we worry about is the sustainability of revenue for the employees in the very large portfolio that they have. Then there would be some of the field with the Chief Investment and Portfolio Manager. Then this shouldn't be active, but in the last financial year it was active, so we've implemented this for all of the time. The FUDG Energy and Board Funding Funds, that's critically. BDG Legal Governance and Risk, that's Ursula Fiorenti. BDG Manufacturing Enterprise, that's John Morris. BDG Transport and Finance, that is Andrew Shaw. The BDG Joint project facility is Catherine Zenia, who has since resigned. The Oxford chairperson is. So that would depend on whether it's the CFO, the head of corporate services, or the head of it's the operation committee basically that reviews all support programs and it's changes. It's CFO, corporate services, and communications. There are people responsible for the environment. And then Sandy Hutchins is the CFO, chief audit executive, that's the name where. Head of communications is Vimla. And then the head of communications is Vimla Maitri, and head of services is Shireen. As far as the test, the establishment is 157 and we've got 138 postals. It's a constant battle to deal with bureaucratic the problem with bureaucracy, and I suppose it's partly the rules also of changing organizational structure, is that there's a stickiness to an organizational structure that even if you don't quite need all 157, but just in case you need them, you keep it. And then it's also the potential argument whenever you run around an organization that everybody desperately needs the person, but in, when they have to fill it, not fully. But then the other real problem that we have to deal with as well is that there are some positions that are really, really difficult to fill. And we've struggled in quite a lot of the areas in which we have the line responsibility. And, you know, the challenges are frankly sometimes the problems of the team. And if we have responsibility for state-owned enterprises, our view has been that if you're not good enough for this, we just don't hire you at the end of the day. Because it is a chairman's risk to start with the department if we take somebody and then we take, because we have to take advice from these people and we make mistakes. So we can prevent that difficulty that we have. And then when you do find available people, the television and public services are often a very real constraint in the hiring, you know. But I think we've done pretty well in the whole. Our vacancy rate is 27.49%. By the end of this year, we also would have done another cleanup to make sure what is essential to our operation going forward. And the average for the public service was 14.6% for this period last year. And the turnover rate was 17.4, with the average for the public service being around 30.35. So on the whole, I mean, I think we've, under struggling difficult times, I think we've been able to do pretty well. But also with the size of the establishment that we have, whenever you lose one or two people, it has a significant impact in terms of numbers. With respect to employment equity targets, generally I think we've really done well. I mean, the one area that we sort of like struggled a bit, and I think a lot of people do struggle with, is on the area of ensuring that people with disabilities are accommodated in the workplace, but also not just at the support staff levels, but at technical levels, which we felt quite strongly about. So in that, the target percentage is 2%, actually, the PSA and the 4%. So it's difficult to ensure that you keep that, because you know, to constantly be bringing in people with disabilities is not entirely the easiest thing to do. And not least of all is the fact that you need a support mechanism that it has to be available in the department at the same time. On the gender equity set, 55% of the SMS, or 56% of the SMS is male and 44% of the SMS is female. We think we might be able to, and if we miss it, we might miss it by a very small margin. Make the target for 31 March of 2009 of 50%. But you know, we would have, I think, done the same given the technical nature of our job. On the race side, gender being doing quite well. However, with respect to the representation of colored people and Indian people in the department, we do need to do a little better, particularly on the male side as opposed to the female side. At ethnic level, to make efficacy, we have to be making sure that we are creating, making sure that the process is desirable in the society for people who are African to work with females in particular. They get good salaries these days, so that is the difficult. In the last financial year, we had 27 interns that we had appointed in the building department, and we really pride ourselves on our internship program. Because given the size of the department, to be able to take 27, and there are some departments which are much bigger than ourselves, who take on a much smaller number. And what has been really exciting is that not only have we been able to appoint some of the interns inside the department, and it's really been a merit for the interns in that, but five were employed by ESCOM. And then many of them, in the course of the year, actually get fully grown once they are BD. One of the things that we did decide to do with the internship program is that we would have an intensive training program as well for many of the students. Mainly in the initial program, but by last year we worked on to get black students from the University of Pretoria. So this notion that initially there was a sense that it was black students who graduates were coming who were formerly black universities were not getting jobs. Now we're finding that black students who stop. Doesn't matter which university they come from, because there's a good number actually who come from the University of Pretoria, who are interns in our department, actually struggle to find jobs, and I think it is a challenge that we have to deal with. So the quality of the interns that we're getting actually is improving phenomenally, to be honest, is that we then focus on a very aggressive training program for them in terms of types and skills that they recognize. Most of us will have to universities without the hottest types and skills that they recognize so that they become a further struggle. So it's been quite gratifying is that when they leave us, a lot of them actually are able to get 15 jobs. We also decided, because there's an area which is a problem for us, is at universities, no economic faculty produces an economist who has specialization in industrial economics for us. They don't often produce, in fact, I don't think in South Africa we do, produce an economist who is a regulatory specialist in energy. And so one of the things that we decided to do is that we would fund support students who are at honors level at the university and would cover at UNISA and the University of the Western Cape, with the specific aim to start sort of like driving universities towards an understanding that that's an area that is a critical requirement by the economy. We'll see how they do, but I mean, there's no, at this stage, we've met a few of them, and in fact, they were asked about the speech, and we think we should be able to get some really good doctors who would be, have to work for DPE, I think, for 2 years, before they can move on. But for us, it would be a few that we have to do in the economy. At this time, I will hand over to Shirley.
Just in terms of corporate services and the areas in corporate services, for planning, monitoring, and evaluation, basically the unit there, in terms of their targets, provided the business plan and quarterly reports for the year. Portia, I'm not sure in terms of the CIP and okay, in CIPM, the achievements for the year was a monitoring and evaluation. They under monitoring and evaluation study, the dashboard has been implemented, and the quarterly portfolio reporting to DPE board was issued. In terms of the CIPM, the business the government shareholder management role was a visit to campus for consideration, and the entire list of action assessments was done. Under the risk of staff settlement agreement, the removal assets were transferred to the risk of staff community, and that was completed in April 2007. Still under CIPM, the alternative claim against government and Transnet, that's an ongoing plan. I'm not sure who she is asking to take over the area. Okay, under HR, the key achievements here basically we focused on training and retention strategies. As Portia has referred to earlier on, retention in DCE remains a critical issue, and we struggle, especially in terms of skills and losing skills to the private sector, and also to mostly to SOEs. Under comms and international relations, is quite a bit to report on here. But I think the highlights for the year would have been the annual report, which was tabled in various key publications that were done, and then the celebratory event to mark the land claim settlement between Alex Hall and the Richter South community. IT, as we all know, I think we're smiling nowadays with IT, but there's been a lot of upgrades in IT since we had the cold food good fight. Technology, which has improved the IT system in DPE. So that's been an area of great improvement. And then in terms of finance, very commendable. We've had an unqualified audit again. I think it's the fourth consecutive year now that DPE has managed to achieve an unqualified audit. And then basically, in terms of all the financial procedures, in terms of regulatory compliance, we've met with all of those throughout the year. The internal audit unit, we've got an approved risk register in place, which has been quite an in-depth process with quite a lot of workshopping. We've had a consultant come in and assist us with that. And we've achieved the register, which is quite an in-depth document now. And we really are keeping it alive in DPE through continuous updates and review of the register. It also forms part of the performance agreement of BDGs and management, basically, that we continuously look at those risks, so we track them and see if there are any new risks that have entered the department during the period. Portia alluded to the electricity consumption project, reduction projects in DPE, and we're moving along nicely with this. It did start in March 2008, so it was just at the beginning, at the end of the year under review. But we've checked it just to show the progress in terms of where we are now. So from March 2008, if we use that as baseline, in 2008, we've had quite a tremendous savings, both in kilowatts per hour, which is 38,912, and the savings in terms of rand and cents. We didn't think that was important at the time to show it in rand and cents, but we have been asked to actually provide that in various, I think, some of the portfolio committees where they've asked for that. So that's a considerable savings in terms of, and we're proud of that because I think as DPE, we are leading in terms of this area with regards to the government department. Okay, I think that's maybe on the trip.
Possibly just to note, in terms of the savings, is the current level is about a 50% reduction in consumption. But also, I think what's important is what is the payback. And at current tariff levels, you're talking about a two-year payback. If the tariffs go to the levels we think, you know, you talk about a year. And for even a household, a year payback is pretty good. Okay, just in terms of the energy enterprises, we just looked at a few of the outputs. One was the introduction of private sector participation, and we do know that going forward they're going to play a much more important role in supplying electricity or providing security of supply in the country. And in the past financial year there we had the cabinet resolution that designated Eskom as a single buyer, and that progressed really speedily. I know you saw the press release for yesterday where they've actually pre-qualified 27 bidders in the baseload IPP process, where they're looking for up to 4.5 megawatts. Of power. They plan to finalize contracting probably near the end of next year, and the power should be delivered into the system from 2012 onwards. So that's moving quite nicely, although there are some regulatory issues. Of the baseload ITCs. They went out on inquiries for between 2,100 and 4,500 megawatts. But the response has been so good, I think they're going to achieve at least the 4,500, if not have possibly more that would be available. I think of note to that process is that in the past, ITCs have always been looked at as going out for a price. This was run as a market process where people put in. And they'll be evaluating the prices now to see how they can rank them. There are regulatory challenges though, because obviously that's the cost point. Yeah. Initially when we told everybody that this should be done, we were told nobody's going to bid. And they were way oversubscribed, so that's very positive. The other one was the National Electricity Emergency Response Plan. We were co-authors of that, and we're part of the implementation through the National Electricity Response Team. And I do know that a lot of people are saying they don't see much happening, but you have to remember a lot of those programs are targeted at residential, and it takes time to manifest on the system. These lights are pretty efficient, and they have these features that give you a soft light, because with this white light it actually wouldn't be very nice to sit there. So this place, even though it's not a comfortable room, was designed reasonably well. The other one was the Eskom Bulk program that did go to cabinet for approval, but that from year to year changes, so we have to come back to cabinet again with the program as it's revised, because the rolling 5-year plan. And as the GD alluded to, there's a lot of tariff issues and also gold issues, tenant issues, etc. Moving on. Essentially, still with energy enterprises, we did issue a strategic intent statement for Eskom, and we signed the compact with Eskom, essentially identifying and reviewing the KPIs, the key performance indicators. Just to mention that this year there was quite a big fight. Because a lot of the metrics have deteriorated significantly, and the temptation there is to just allow them to be worse. But you have to try and get to a balance so that you can strive to be better than what you actually would be by default. So, but we did manage to come to an agreement with them. Just on the nuclear enterprise, which is essentially PBMR, is PBMR tabled its first annual report in Parliament on time. They were given a hot commissioning license for the advanced coker facility, essentially for the pebbles. There was an approval of a strategic framework for the market development of the high temperature reactor for process heat applications in the North American market. And then they've also been involved in this next generation nuclear plant project over in the States. They interfaced two parts of it. And then they've also been operating the helium test facility accident-free, 100,000 accident-free operating hours. And with nuclear safety, is obviously paramount. And then broadband enterprises. Essentially, we said they updated the business plan, and as a line, it doesn't seem a lot, but effectively to get a proper business plan for InfraCo being so new, it did take a bit of doing, but that was done. They started recruiting permanent employees, and they've got, I think they have about a 10% vacancy rate at the moment. They've completed the terrestrial network, and what they've done on the submarine or West Coast cable essentially was to design and configure it, but there are still issues around the funding and the rollout there.
In the legal governance system. And under legal targeted of people we completed the MOU with Delhi in respect of the compensation to Alexco for assessing for the restitution people. That was completed. And then we also concluded the
MOU with DBSA in preparation for the handover of the Alexco Bay Township Development Project to DBSA as implementing agent. That was also completed. We the broadband in Farco and Setfield were promulgated and came into effect on 1 February 2018. The transfer of assets and service networks, metropolitan assets and network operation facilities to the Neotel, that was completed as well. We also completed the promotion of access to information manual, that's the entire manual for internal purposes. And then the addendum on Aventura was also concluded. We drafted and developed the guidelines and on escrow and management buyout. Those were the guidelines on employee ownership.
Chair, I just want to go back on the Aventura case. The Aventura remains an unenclosed, unfinished transaction which was started somewhere prior to 2004. And it remains, and in fact, we are now in the process of making recommendations to the minister to come to closure of the transaction. And the core issue has been, at the point when we were due to transfer all of the assets and maybe to whoever it was who was the winner of the transaction, they then suddenly came out almost out of woodwork, so to speak, other companies who were alleging that they were promised other assets that would have been under Electro, that were never quite transferred, under Insurer, that were never quite transferred. And so that partly has been an issue is to try and find any records that suggest that there were assets left out of the transaction possible, which would use to have been transferred to Aventura that were never transferred to Aventura Electric. And then secondly, to find proof of the fact that there had been any such offers made in a legal, formal fashion towards these other parties. So exactly, it's the main serious index problem, because each time we're about to get closure, suddenly an exodus pops out from the woodwork. It worries us, this transaction, because it does remain a serious risk. So that means that we have to constantly keep oversight to ensure that we are earning revenue from the leases and the rental rights of the property. So it remains something of great concern once that is still not finalized. But I think in the next year we will have to we allow the people to push closure.
Thank you. Still under legal, but on litigation. The Navarra versus Alexco and government matter has been held in abeyance and has not, the matter has not been set down for hearing in court. The Paculo de Rosa Consortium against the Minister in Paco, contesting the decision to make the Kumasi land translation that is still going.
At the time it was still
ongoing, but this has been finalized. Moving forward, under governance, the ESCOM, SAA, Subcall, and DINEL shoulder contact were signed. The governance framework and tools contribute to effective monitoring and management of SOE corporate governance. This was also completed. The governance audit template, it was in the process of finalization and internal sign-off. This has subsequently been completed as well. The board induction tool and training, completed and signed off by Minister. Generic founding document for all SOEs. Internal processes completed. This was subsequently finalized. And reviewed remuneration guidelines. This was approved by cabinet. Under the risk section,
the risk management framework for shareholder level risk, which was completed. The MOU in respect of the significant and materiality framework in respect of NED, FASCO, SAA, SPECS, and FASCOL, this was completed in the process of implementation. I must say, most of the SOEs have subsequently signed the MOU in respect of the significant and materiality framework. And last year, we processed and monitored processing and monitoring of Section 54 to KFMA applications. The 8 applications were received and processed, and SOE risk reporting dashboard. Okay. Section 54.2 section that deals with significant, which requires the SOE to report or to apply for approval before entering into certain significant transactions. So in terms of the KFMA, state owned enterprises are required to make a formal application to the Minister for approval before entering into those KFMA. And in support of it, we have concluded the MOU with sort of act as a guideline or supplement the 254 or the KFMA.
The significant and materiality framework, what's that?
The significant and materiality framework is a tool that was developed by the department to sort of act as a guideline and supplement the Section 54.2 process. This is sort of sets out the limits within which SOEs can enter into certain transactions and prohibit certain transactions.
If I may just extend, but is it in most companies, in the shareholders agreement, you would normally have those issues which are reserved by the shareholder. They are predefined. And in that instance, when you enter into a transaction in those areas, you are obliged by the shareholders agreement to approach the shareholder for final decision. In effect, what Section 54.2 does is define the areas which are areas for shareholder approval, first of all. What the materiality and significance framework then does is that it creates limits in terms of what it is that must come to the shareholder. So it's a size risk that above a certain size in a transaction, it has to come to final approval by the shareholder. See, below a certain size, it gets dealt with by the company. And in the company, then you would normally have what we call delegation. There would be the powers of the board, and there would be the delegation that goes to the CEO and write down in terms of their powers to undertake particular elements of things. The significance and materiality frameworks are just that the framework is the same. However, the levels are not the same for all of the SOEs because we've got to take into account the size of the SOE and the access that they have at the risk.
Still under risk, SOE risk reporting dashboard that was developed and the establishment of a 2010 risk task team. This is still ongoing. Then under transactions, the transaction guidelines for the Komati land forest transaction, this was concluded, and the transfer of minority shareholding, the framework was completed and it is in the process of implementation. The employee share ownership scheme, transactions, this relates to the Komati land. All remaining transfers to employees were completed. Under Secretariat, coordination and management of the internal forum for committee and DPE-led external forum. Approved meeting schedules, five economic cluster progress reports to cabinet, and the 2008 January report that report was approved. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm wondering whether we shouldn't at this stage just have an engagement process, seeing as they only see us. Oh, for Anna! perhaps we can just we can have an engagement process on what is delivered to us now, and then we're going to go into the next stage, the other presentation, and then the stage presentation on the handle. So I'm sure there are lots of issues in the that will be resolved in time. Let's see some hands from members. I'm just going to run with the questions you guys will drop them out and then of course I can just push your
Thank you for the presentation. It's very concise and to the point. I'm kind of fishing particularly on your InfraCo and CSDP. I know that you said earlier that CSDP has been officially the framework has been agreed by that cabinet. I'm just thinking now with InfraCo going to be involved with the cable infrastructure act, how has InfraCo been working with CSDP in terms of creating a local, possibly creating a local industry to manufacture these fiber optic cables, and if you can't do that, obviously also creating new small players laying these cables, so surely it would make more sense for that and to lay the cables rather than creating products to lay the cables. And further to that point is the status of the African Ways Cable Project. I'm just wondering now, given the global economic recession that's expected to come and the possible change of project variety this afternoon, how has this project been affected in terms of the budget and also the difficulty of getting finance to subsidize this? And given that InfraCo's mandate is when we established the vote, InfraCo's mandate was to provide cheap access and infrastructure to domestic needs. I didn't think that international needs was one of priority. Obviously, it's needed as much as I am for international connectivity, but that's going to be at the cost of the African needs. Are there other priorities in terms of the social needs and similar to what the one resolution wanted for the ruling party. So that's just the thing on InfraCo. And then secondly, the issue on PBMR, which I mentioned, it is an energy project we need, but I'm just concerned with the environmental standards. I've heard that the American has refused to give standard approval in terms of environmental standards. I don't know whether that's true or not, and I'm just concerned that given that the EPR is planning to export these technology in the future, without any international approval or on the environmental standards, how effective or how successful are we going to export these technology? I mean, who's going to buy from us? And then lastly, perhaps just on the internship program, I think there's definitely one of the departments that has done very well compared to the other departments that we have gone through in my other committee. But I just want to find out in terms of the turnover, is the department planning to have the internship program as high turnover training ground, or are you going to absorb much of the internship candidates? The reason why I'm saying this is the national youth policy from 08 to 2013, we have the research has shown that the youth population is going to be the main population that in the years to come, given the youth pouch. And one of the things that we suffered here, 60% to 70% of the unemployed people are actually youth. So I think the internships are quite important. At the same time, we want to create a global a domestic environment so that's suitable to solve these problems. So obviously, we would like to internship to run other parts. So how should our department learn from your department and what is the long term plan given that you had an internship study in this department 2 years ago or 3 years ago? Thank you.
Thank you.
mean, that you may have realized that, okay, well, she shouldn't be electrocuted, so you change your KPIs and sat down, and hello, you know, I'm still on that a year later. You guys have kind of moved on. So what I want to find out was your KPIs are drafted quite broadly. Is there not the possibility of the committee getting those KPIs as and when you complete them prior to the end of the year? And then at some point, we can then ask you specifics around, you know, what does that mean exactly, and why would you guys insist on this particular target as opposed to that target and so on? So that we can develop further insights into why those particular targets are opposed to something else. As it happens, we can't, because we see the year later. Very simple question. So really the question is, can we not just get a copy of those key performance indicators, or even if not the key performance indicators, some kind of background guidance to say, these were our issues when we decided that the key performance indicators were suggested, and others. The West Coast table coming through to Instagram. I'm not sure. Look, Chris has asked you about some of those issues, and you've alluded to some of the challenges and so on. But is there like a time frame? Do you guys, I know you've had to adapt things and so on. Do you have a time frame there so that we have some sense? Initially, we were told that the stuff would have to be in place by 2010. That's sort of the time frame where we're going with it. Just go to slide 34 for me. I think it's slide 34. We've done it already. It's the Adam Tudor, I think. Reading that will understand something quite different from what the group is saying. Now, the reason I'm pointing this out is you know, we have been fairly understanding of the fact that we get information from the department and that we don't try and, you know, source it elsewhere, and we don't try and kind of go behind the department's back and so on. Now, I take this kind of thing pretty seriously because you are the one source of information to us. If you didn't interrogate or you didn't intervene for on this issue of Aventura, that would have been what you would have been reporting to the committee. Not the issue of things coming out of the woodwork and that we still need to close this transaction and that we have a few proposals and so on. And I think that this is the one thing that this department must be very careful on, because what you have to realize is that there's a certain integrity that you have to display here. Now, whether this is merely a kind of sleight of hand or whatever it is, or maybe even just trying to tracy something that shouldn't have been traced in that particular way, I'm not going to comment on. All I'm saying to you and all I'm pointing out to you is that there's a difficulty when you come and you represent in this way, whether it's deliberate or not deliberate, I'm not even going to make a call, that you have six particular responsibility to this committee and to Parliament to report in a way that does not, shall we say, promote a misunderstanding. Then the fire manual, I think completed, I think each of us made a copy. Every member of Parliament should have one, if the department has got one. It doesn't help. The whole point of a fire manual was to ensure that members of the public are interested when they need information. And it doesn't help that there's not the information of one yet. And it's commendable enough to have been one of the two departments. And I could have managed to have that manual, and I know that it's a lot of work that has gone into it. So that's my last word.
Chair, let's start with the first one, because it's, we have the fire manual, so we'll get those things done.
Yeah.
If you go, Chair, you don't have the copy, I don't think you have the hard copy. I just want to make sure that you understand that it's actually the truth as we've been facing today. What I was doing was telling you the situation that we now find ourselves in. The objective that we had at the time was to complete the transaction. We needed to do addendums to the original transaction because, remember, in the intervening period, there was a change in the legislation about where the watermark had to be, here the watermark was. So, in effect, the size of the land that we sold had to shrink, because the watermark shifted, and so effectively the point at which the watermark had shifted, because remember all of the aventurers are up and around dams, so that land would have then become part of the dam, whoever owns the dam, and then the resort piece would be the piece that's left on the other side. So we needed to undertake that addendum to the sale agreement so that we adjust rights across the board and renegotiate price with the forever resort in as far as that was concerned. On conclusion of that, we would then have been able to finalize the transaction because we would have then had dealt with all matters that needed to be dealt with. Indeed, we did that. The addendum was done. So as far as the addendum to the transaction and to the assets is concerned, finished waiting there for handover. The only reason why, and it is reflected as though in the annual report we were supposed to say, why we haven't been able to close then, as we indicated there, is that we are awaiting the finalization of the litigation in order to transfer the remaining assets. So really, I think it's a matter of just how it would look at this in the presentation, but in the annual report, it's accurately listed. I was just, you know, expanding on this a little bit.
All I'm saying, just let's be careful about how we phrase everything. If somebody was to just read that, and, you know, what we use these slides for is to allow us to pick up some issues that would involve us going to the annual report and making a certain study of it. When we see stuff like that, when we say addendum concluded, you're the only ones who know what's in the addendum. When I see something like addendum concluded, that means tick to me. Okay? It's just a responsibility that you have to just make sure that we understand what page you're on as well.
We'll make sure about that. Now, next, the very CDG deal with the SOE and all of the questions that were asked, and I'll come back and support you for your questions. So, Chris, if you can do the end process.
Okay, the answer to Chris was about Infocom and the CSDP, and I don't work with CSDP, so unless someone else can take that question.
What we have procured today on the Infracom is the optical part of the network for the terrestrial part of the network. Of the terrestrial part of the network, based on the capacity that was available in the country at the time, and it's not the only reason that they have been able to pay for even its own procurement policy. What was done with the CFDB once it was approved was to ensure that we almost built in a bias that would ensure if there was a competitive supplier in the market, and that's really the key issue. If there's a competitive supplier in the market, we would procure from that supplier. From the information that we have from the history, 40% of that was taken from the central reporting. That's the case. Obviously, for the undersea cable, we don't make undersea cables in South Africa, so that's the 100% important. However, only all local contractors will use. You'll note that Infracore doesn't have a DSCP, by the way. The CFTP, the Competitive Supplier Program, is an alternative to the National Industrial Participation Program. So if you are doing a small procurement which doesn't have a long history, a long-term profile of 5, 6, 10 years, for instance, in those instances, the SOE has to revert back to using the National Industrial Participation Program. So that would have been the conditions that would have attached to that procurement. Would have been an
NIT. Okay, in terms of the International Environmental Standard Approval, yeah, there are some problems, but I do know that TVMR have done a lot of work with the US, and I believe the regulators actually either have been here or they're coming here to do some work with them to get around it. They're not.
There's a cooperation agreement because one of the things with the TDMR being first in time technology, it's not only a problem in South Africa, the licensing was not given, it's not a challenge only in South Africa. So the US regulator as well would work with our regulator in and out to bolster the team to ensure that whatever, because then it helps with the efficiency of the licensing process also in the US. If they participate in the process in South Africa as well, so that by the time it comes to the US for approval and licensing directly, they would have made sure or had understood better what the processes would have been implemented by the regulator directly in South Africa. The question that you also yourself, Andrew Lehman, as well as the chair, inquired about the motion of change, we do still have motion of change. The court undersea cable deadline, actually, that frankly you can't push past, is the SKA payment, which is 2013 or thereabouts. With the expansion of the capacity and upgrade of that thing by Telkom, they've got more than enough capacity to be able to broadcast the World Cup in 2010. The objective has always been to be able to have the capacity by the beginning of 2010. And then the date now that they're working on is the end of 2010. But the risk that member raises is real, is that on, given the financial crisis now and also the state of even the government going forward, we will see whether all of the members are able to progress on a funding model for the rest of the year. And I think we'll get the reference there after the Minister of Finance makes his year from the street on how Infracore ends up faring, but to be honest, we're just nervous about that. But then, if we don't get the anticipated outcome, we obviously need to be able to look at what are the other funding options, and obviously what are the implications, because in the end, it might mean that we go to the bank and lose capacity and what we would have wanted. Usually, though, is that in the discussions with the Department of Communications, there is focus on the licensing of Infracore, because they can get it by the minister, and I think it's it's literally a process to get because they call the licensing of Infracore to go ahead.
Thank you. With regard to the internet, we'd love to take moving on every year and it's all building infrastructure. That would mean basically that we grow by between 10% and 15% per annum in terms of our accomplishments. We do try as much as possible to absorb interns who have really shown good potential during the year and growth. And we have to balance that with the needs in the department. So especially in our areas where we've got key skills, like in energy and manufacturing and that, we try the most times we can't afford them at a high level. So we try and look at getting an entry-level job, more than an entry-level post, and put them in infrastructure there. It is a difficulty that we deal with. But unfortunately, also in terms of the internship program, we've got to balance that with the fact that we've got a continuing program, so that every year we're getting new interns in, retraining them to the best of our ability, and we're sending them out there. And what we have experienced with the program is that our interns are really well, they train really well. They go out there and they get quite high positions in other departments or in the private sector. So that's why in the reflection that we're doing the right thing in terms of the coaching and the training that we offer them. So on the one hand, we do ensure that we give them optimal training that equips them to be able to go out and get employment. As I say, in terms of absorbing them, we do have a restriction there, unfortunately. In terms of how other departments can learn from us, it's something that I suppose I'd have to maybe approach the GNI cluster on to see if there's anything that we can, in terms of best practice around us, if there's anything that we can teach them, we'd be willing to do that. In terms of the other HR issue on the screening of candidates and employees in the department, we do that at shortlisting stage before we appoint the person. They go through a preliminary RIA reference checking, and we also do reference checks with previous employment. Once you are employed in the department, you do a full-term screening, a full-scale screening with RIA, which is the process that they follow. So it's all the forms and that we've got to complete and submit to them. We do have issues around that. The time, the turnaround time for RIA is quite hectic in terms of ensuring that we get that. But at the moment, I'll say to you, usually, I think we've got two officials who have not yet received their full screening, and that's not due to their not completing the forms they submitted, but they're fairly new employees. Then the other thing that we do by regulation is every 5 years, we've got to have a re-screening done in terms of the NIA permit standards. So then our interns, employees, contractors, service providers, consultants, they all get screened as well. We all sign confidentiality agreements and all of that is filed. We check that as well on an annual basis for all the young people doing the department. I'm not sure if I've gone for that.
On the travel, the contact, two questions. Can we deal with the one, because we're still trying, I'm finding out from the DPD, so they'll have to give the report on which ones are done for this year. The cause in the contact, effectively what you have as the target, often is an indicator of operationally what the company is going to do. It's for that reason that we can't review the KPIs for the current year in advance, and that's one of the reasons, in fact, when we have done the GSM, the Government Shareholder Management Model, one of the changes that we were recommending is that in terms of Parliament, the portfolio committee that's responsible for stakeholder enterprises, we needed to have those intelligence type rules so that we would be able to share confidential information with the staff and that it's not made public. So if we were able to get around that problem, I think it's eminently possible to do that. However, I think it's an interim stopgap measure. It's quite possible for us to have a discussion in a workshop with you about where we do show what are the dimensions of the contact, even if we didn't have the numbers, but we could show last year's numbers for that matter, and indicate why a particular measure and why not another measure. And whenever we made a change to a measure, also indicate why we moved away from a previous measure or are moving to whatever is the kind of measure. And what we try to do is that the contact, the documents that we've done, there's a fair amount of high-level contact or indicators that would be located in that. However, underlying it, which is not part of the contact in truth, but it's important detailed performance indicators that we'd like to have to see how the system is performing. You see, one of the lessons that we've learned in this EFCOM crisis is that we sat back and we asked ourselves the question, what are the things that we should have been able to look at in the data coming out of EFCOM that should have alerted us to a problem emerging so that in future we actually are watching those things as well so that we can also have our own early warning system. So it's that level of preparation. So it's part of the workshop with the committee anytime, and I think it's absolutely useful. And I get the point that if somebody makes a report and they say that they've made a particular target, let's take the target.
frankly, is it the most important part of it, actually? And they haven't made the most important part. I do think it's a sensible concern that we should make to yourselves that we have a workshop and we can go through all of them quite happily. But I think for starters, I think going forward in the next financial year, if prior to we receiving the annual report from the FOE, we then have maybe a one-day workshop with the committee where we go through all of the compacts, all of the indicators, and then we leave you with that information so that in the interrogation process of the FOE, you would be able to then have the empowered to be able to deal with the report by the FOE. And as far as... Now the one area of adjustment in the government shareholder management model that we've been looking at doing is the shareholder, the negotiation of the contract, the shareholder contract is a moment of great tension between BPE and the company. Technically, I think sometimes we've been pretty unwise in what we've negotiated with, which is sometimes managing, negotiating with management, as opposed to arriving at agreement with the board and walking out with up to the board to make sure that the company does indeed implement that. Now, under ideal circumstances, you'd like to have the shareholder contract signed in April, at the beginning of each year, because there's a new business plan that the company is implementing. And actually, we had agreed that their part of the contract should be evergreen, which would only, if it's a longer-term project, it takes a little bit longer. So it's not an annually adjusted measure. So that's one area of tension. So we never quite get them done in the beginning of the year. Then the next time that we always target to get it done by is in the AGM. In certain instances, we get it done to get them signed at the AGM. So there are a few, which ones were signed at the AGM. And then there are some which we weren't able to sign. Now, the ones that would have been difficult to sign in the AGM this year were PVMAT. Because, you know, it's a different process that goes to us, so we wouldn't have one. In fact, we can't, because we're not a shareholder at this particular juncture. Once we're going through the process of developing beyond the turnaround strategy that they produced, was also, we were at this particular juncture. We then needed to move beyond the point that we're at and going forward. That one is not concluded at this point. Transnet is not signed. I think we sent it to the board of Transnet for them to come back in time. Denal is also with the board at this particular juncture. Eskom, I think, is that? Yeah, Eskom and Interco is with their board. So it's always an issue in the end to sort of like get to a point where you've got a signed contract. Now, one of the changes that we want to make in the proposal that we've made in the government, in the shareholder management model, is that in the PSMA, there is a requirement that the company must submit to the shareholder department, and this is a standard problem for everybody else, to the shareholder department, the corporate plan. However, we don't have power to approve the corporate plan. So one of the changes that we wanted to do was to ensure that we have the power to approve the corporate plan. Because if we then approve the corporate plan, we would then take the targets from the corporate plan, and basically those would then become the contracts, and that would take care of an administrative hurdle that we have. So now, and that's partly why it's such a tense process, is that you have the corporate plan, and in the corporate plan, the FOE will have whatever it says as its targets. And then we work on the contract, which is sometimes not the same areas that are covered in the corporate plan, which includes the targets that the FOE has to work with. Can't be the one in the contract, in the corporate plan, because that's not what we signed, that's not what we approved, has got to be the one in the contract. If we were able to align the governance process, then we approve the corporate plan, then in effect, that takes care of quite a huge chunk of tensions that that exist, because then the company is not living in some ways in two universes, where for its board, it satisfies the corporate plan, but they have a shareholder who's watching the contact on the other side. So it remains an issue going forward. So two signs, corporate plans at this juncture is not very checked at all. But it really is just a reflection of that problem. But as indicated, a lot of them are now with the board and with the signature from the board. But hopefully in the future going forward, we change that. You then are able, but I think so you're able to have a contact which is available at the beginning of each financial year and direct what we do. It's also quite crucial for us because then when you do quarterly performance assessment and in fact monthly whenever or is necessary, you have a common base on which you're comparing performance and you're not constantly in a tense relationship with an enterprise. I want to go back to an area which you asked a question on when we were discussing materiality and significant framework. On the materiality, things like what we would have done, that's the Fatani referred to it, is the framework, the remuneration framework, it's for the board. And the only executive would cover, what two executives would cover, is the CEO and the CFO, but the rest is a framework, the rest of the remuneration framework, incentives and the rest of the line are taken care of by the company, the board itself was covering. So the incentive program as well would be something that's developed by the board and management and approved by the board. It is not defined at this stage as a material and significant activity, so it doesn't come for shareholder approval. There may be a discussion with the shareholder representative around what the incentive program looking like, but it's not something that we particularly are active participants in as the process. Given the noise that often attaches to the salaries and the bonuses of FOE, which I think sometimes is technically unfair, there may be state-owned companies, but at the end of the day, we have to compete with the market for the CEOs that we have in the state-owned enterprises. And I don't think that there's any doubt that the CEOs that we have running these companies are first-rate CEOs. So what we did try to do was to normalize that process. Salary, remuneration, and the reason like is always a board prerogative. But we did try to set some sense of a framework on the back of the size of the enterprise. And frankly, often actually is it in a competitive environment, what's the level of difficulty that the company has to deal with. The ESTA issue we'll deal with and provide to you, Jake. Let's come back to the screening of employees, because I think there are limits of what you can do. Agree totally that ours we deal with confidential information and you have to worry about who works in DPE. But the risk is, we have access to the information. If a transmitter goes into the market to raise money, they've got to give quite a lot of financial information to an advisory firm. And the level that an advisory firm or bank or whatever would screen themselves is not the same as saying the fact. So the risk on the information is the presence at any given time. We're not the only risk that they have to deal with. But one of the things that we've done in the department so that we actually in some ways adopt a much more commercial stance to this question of risk inherent is that not only do you get screened, but you also sign a confidentiality agreement with the department. And what we always try to do is that it's an actionable confidentiality agreement. And then on a case-by-case basis, because sometimes when we get into looking at a transaction which is really, really, really confidential, we would then sign explicitly new NDAs that relate to that particular project over and above the standard confidentiality that we would assign all of us coming into the department. So that is, in a sense, it adjusts the effect, and I think the point that you were raising is that this changes, is dynamic throughout the period in the year. And it is all 5-year period if you have a 5-year contract, because otherwise if you keep it static, you know, it's a strong presumption. There's also the other problem, which I think is a broader, near question. In DPE, and I think not only in DPE, in all government departments, we would apply to NEA and say, my PA and a range of PAs should have public clearance, because we know the PA has received the documents at the end of the day, and you've got to make sure. And then you have a machinery on the other side, which uses its discretion to decide who does and who doesn't need public clearance. But I think it's an area that we've actually got to work on, because I'm the only one that just knows the level of risk that I face. And so so some of these, I think, areas that require additional work going forward. But the best that we can do is that in every single instance, if we think there's a particular higher level of risk, we then define it and we treat it as such, and we've got to then sign new agreements that attach specifically to that particular item. On the ESTA, we will get the guide for the responsible of the ESTA to give a one-page report of what it does and what's the current program that we're working on.
Now take some tea because I'm told that it's late outside and it's warm. I tried quite nice to get warm coffee upstairs, so hopefully I can serve that. We're going to just grab tea and I suggest to come back immediately and then we'll continue with the conversation.
$933 million in recapitalization to the NAL. It's transferred in 3 tranches during the 07-08 financial year that was completed. We then had to enter the market to assist the NAL with a short-term borrowing requirement of R1.3 billion. A guarantee application was made in November. The first tranche was agreed to by Minister of Finance in June. The first tranche of $880 million and the second tranche of $420 million was agreed in August 08. The defence sector strategy, which we presented previously at last year's summer school, went to Cabinet on the 5th of December. It's approved by Cabinet, and we've initiated discussions with the DTI to develop a customised sector program, which is a direct outflow of that strategy. Further work with DOD and achieving closer alignment is underway. One of the key areas of work that flowed out of the defence sector strategy was the NAL's further restructuring and consolidation and alignment between defence requirements, strategic requirements, and future restructuring of the NAL. We focused on 4 business areas where further interventions were required. That report was finalized it was required to be finalized by 31 March 08. It was indeed finalized early April and was presented to Cabinet in June, and I believe that we will be presenting it to the Portfolio Committee in order to update you. Recently held workshops with the DOD on implementation of that restructuring framework, and it would be a good opportunity to brief you on the outcome of a recent workshop held on the 13th and 14th of October. In terms of the dairy, the Comms Corp finalized a study on the appropriate corporate form, in which Gary will take. If you recall, there is the Defense Evaluation and Research Institute, which will consolidate national primarily test and evaluation facilities, and will also perform an R&D function for the industry, and particularly for the DoD as a core client. That report was finalized, DPE assessed. Interim CEO has been appointed by Arms Corp. There is currently a discussion on the appropriate reporting relationship. We undertook research on a financing mechanism to support not only defense but strategic SOE exports, given that there's pre-shipment and post-shipment financing requirements as major long-term projects are undertaken. The current levels or quantums of finance provided by the ECIC, we found that the ECIC does have schemes, but the nature of the contracts and the quantums exceeded what capacity the ECIC had. We finalized that research based on international best practice, reached agreement with the ECIC on implementation, and the DTI will need to take that process forward with the Treasury. Your R&D strategy, a lot of work went into the Denali space, and so we had to prioritize, reprioritize that project. In terms of SAPCO, the members will recall that SAPCO's role was reviewed and its specific role in the forestry economy was reviewed. That would be the role of KLF and the holding company SAPCO. That decision went to Cabinet. We developed transaction guidelines for the disposal of Kamati land forests. However, complexities around a resolution of the land claims, which account for about 60% of the land on which KLM operates, is under claim, and issues around furthering competition in the sector necessitated a longer time frame for disposal, but particularly a model that will benefit local communities, and so the land settlement model will go hand in hand with the disposal model. And that process is now being undertaken jointly with the Departments of Land Affairs, Water Affairs, and Forestry, where a work program has been developed, and we're setting up a task team to manage implementation of that work program. The first priority being identifying exactly where communities are in relation to the settlement, and in correlation to the location of the SAPCO or KLF forestry areas.
Are you sticking to your initial target, or does it take into account the change that was brought to the SAPCO's mandate by the minister? I think it was around May of this year, which was set to the finalized target. All of this is about winding down and disposal and so on. When we did successful, they were on a different pitch. What exactly is it that you're meaning by this?
What we're reporting against is the objective that was set at the beginning of the 07-08 financial year. So yes, indeed, you're correct. The minister had indicated a period of 5 years due to the complexities, and SAPCO has now submitted that 5-year plan, and we have assessed that. So you are correct. So things have moved beyond
that. Where's the 5-year plan that was submitted by SAPCO, and who's to fix that? Where is that now?
SAPCO submitted the 5-year plan in, I believe, the end of August, sorry, September this year, and DPE has assessed that plan.
And the
have an agreement. We in general agreement with the general trust. There's some specifics that we need to iron out with SAFCO, and it ended the meeting with the minister and SAFCO.
But at the same time, you're meeting with
Landcare
and so on to deal with other issues.
We're reporting on staff here, so the stuff that we would have done now, obviously, all the child is now.
Yeah.
So we'll be discussing in the next year, then we'll report. But yet, the decision, the change, the subtle shift in decision is not a shift away from the disposal. It's an acceptance of the fact that because of the land case that associated with the forestry practices that we're talking to are so significant and so extensive in terms of the land, I think 80% of the land, you can't continue the transaction. So what we've then done is that they have a 5-year development program, because we've just estimated that it will probably take 5 years to resolve the land claim issues. So we would continue with the resolution of the land claim issues. At the end of the process, when the land claim has been resolved, we would then do a reassessment of the decision to dispose of that cost. And at that time, approach cabinet again to go ahead to either stop the disposal or proceed with the disposal. But at that particular junction, all of these other material obstacles to the disposal would have been dealt with, and then we should be able to continue the transaction. So in a sense, the 5-year plan is a whole plan once the final decision is made after all the land has been done.
When we left SAFCO, we were given a presentation on the various options pertaining to the vaccine and the various scenarios that could actually pan out. And we were quite impressed with some of the options set up, because it kind of showed win-win situation very much related to the kind of fact that you've got with Alice, for example. My sense was almost that SAFCO was sitting there with all of these options, but was getting precious little feedback as to the process happening at the land bank. And there was this vacuum almost, but they had all these ideas which would really see. I mean, you can't expect people to run forests. So they have some very interesting ideas about how people can be brought into the forestry industry and so on, and continue being owners of their plantation, but feed into a larger scene, and there were different options and different scenarios to discuss. Now, what I'm trying to understand is what comes before what. Do you guys actually go and say, look, we're embracing these following options? Why? Because we think that this is the best case scenario for everybody concerned. And we're going to push this with land affairs, and we're going to, or are we going to sit back and say, well, land affairs sort out whatever you need to sort out, and then we'll come to the party, and then we can discuss whether SAFCO is going to go ahead or not? I mean, because that's the crucial difference in terms of the structure that I would like to get from your perspective.
I mean, I think it would be, I think, a deviation of duty on our part if we didn't, as the shareholders, basis, ensure that the company had a strategy that at work maintained the value of the assets. The better position to be in is that we must improve the value of the assets. We incidentally believe that there's quite an interesting thing, quite a lot of interesting innovations that we can make, particularly in the house, bringing in for us, really, general the board base and how. In the forestry sector, but the question that we ask, and so the people actually who are even much more interested in terms of coming on board sooner rather than later, is not so much land, because land is not something that has really long term to identify who the beneficiaries are and the reason why. If as soon as WAF develops a conservation strategy, they do have at least a certain sense of intent for an a conservation strategy. Is then as soon as they do that and they start sort of like sketching what this development agency would look like in forestry, I think there's a lot more that we could do in terms of the dialogue between what on the assets that we have, SAFCO has, and their aspirations. that we could look at working jointly together. So I think at the end, we would approve the plans that they have, but we'll obviously always assist them around the plan. So we would do that. But the long-term strategy on how you use the forestry and its assets for a broad-based employment, community involvement in a sustainable fashion, that's really the strategy that we want to develop. And we've been in contact with at least at my level, with the Danish Journal as well, and they're still in the process of developing those ideas. And as soon as I think, especially also, you know, around the question of where are the forestry assets best leveraged? Are they best leveraged in UBE, or are they best leveraged in WAF as part of the policy development agency? And I think we're quite open to have a couple of discussions on that, but I think they need to have a for them to make that argument from us as well.
I think what we need to get from you guys is your input into that process. And we would like to see your thinking on that issue, because as you know, SACO has been one of the things that the study group has been on climate energy. And our view is all in again that as far as possible, it's an enterprise that really has the potential to kickstart your rural development program in a way that is extremely meaningful. And it's just a no-brainer for me. You can't say that it's brain surgery to grow trees. Mm-hmm. You know, and the kind of barriers and kind of turnoffs that you get into this output into is quite suited, I think, for our geography, our capacity as a country as well. So, politically for us, this is quite an important insight, and we would like to get more information from you. But again, we can't send you the book in time. I want to try. Not even trace down. I'm scared to say trace, because then you put loaded words in there. It's a lot of stuff. So give me stuff I can read, and so that I can ascertain what it is. And I think that you guys have engaged that on their various options that they have to get out, which would, when I say we find very hard to get there with it.
Participation for NUHA, and the minister approved the framework which would cater for a private operator in NUHA, and what is essential is also rail connectivity to Gauteng. The port and rail master plan, that's waiting to get into cabinet and been approved by the minister. And the objective is that planning 50 years ahead for demand based on the growth of the economy. The review of the Port Act has been, the review has been completed, and the review is to determine the obligations of parties of Transnet and our minister. The evaluation, the consultant has completed the evaluation. DOT is leading, the Department of Transport is leading the project, and DP is facilitating that now. On branch line restructuring, the definitions of the core network and the branch lines have been approved, and the strategy, the minister approved the strategy, which says that the structures will be established in Transnet freight rail to house the branch lines, and then we'll move on, will be housed within the Department of Transport at a later stage, which has yet to be determined. As far as aviation, okay, The turnaround strategy is going according to plan. The 7-8 profit before restructuring is 123 million. And after restructuring, it's a loss of 1.3. And the forecast for 2008-09 is a break-even situation. If the oil price hadn't risen, they would have actually achieved their objective, achievably objective of 7.5% of the turnover that after restructuring. As far as the recapitalization, they received a 1.5 or 1.6 capital injection. SAA is undercapitalized, and the closure of SAA would have a devastating impact on the economy, because SAA accounts for the largest inflow of foreign tourists into South Africa. Also, the geographical imperative of where South Africa is situated at the end of the continent. So there's no large network airlines in the region, and so SAA has to be involved in supplying some intercontinental routes. If SAA is not in the region, other international airlines, it would be dependent on other international airlines would then charge higher rates. The medium-term role of SAA, SACS and Mango, those have been incorporated into the plan. And SAA is defined as an African carrier with limited connectivity and intercontinental destination. SACS is a regional air service carrier on the secondary route. And Mango is defined as a low-cost carrier. There are many low-cost carriers in the world, and SAA is going to consider the aircraft deployment and the route profitability at the end of May for the whole network. The long-range aviation strategy. IATA has been appointed to advise. That would evaluate SAA's performance on its long-haul routes and compare to competitors. And it would also include a comparable study of traffic flows in South Africa compared to similar comparable destinations in the world. And so we want to actually see how SAA compares to the competitors and the effect on the bailout strategy.
The 1.96 is a guarantee and not a cash injection. And I think the question of guarantees and how we apply to something that we have to approach it can be in capitalization. So the guarantee was given to SAA would use the guarantee for a lot of cash into the company. It's an area that we want to have long discussion. I don't think
we need to have long discussions. I mean, I'm not an economist. Going to use it as a, I can still understand if you want to use it in a Transnet, which has a firm balance sheet, but you want to use it in SAA, which is still in the midst of restructuring and so on. I mean, it sounds really hot, and maybe you can explain to me why it's done, because I don't understand it. But I think what I want members to do is, can we spend some time on SAA? Because, this is always stuff that's in the media, and it's always stuff that, frankly, I can't explain a lot of the stuff. So, members, I think can we just spend some time on SAA and pose whatever questions? I don't know if members particularly have questions because I have quite a few. Robin,
Mine are far from this, but I'm not this one. I had a question in terms of the capital injection. And then the DG was trying to say what to highlight to us that it's not a cash, but if it's a guarantee, I don't know important that when you meet the area going to pray, whatever he promised to us, now it's either it's low or it's either high or it's not, nobody seems to be committed to it. Can you find the situation of that meeting? I'm trying to say, can we find a situation where a commitment is down the line is being questioned?
Yeah, look, I also, I think, unless Chris has other questions, and Rob, you're done, are you? Rob?
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, okay, look, we received a briefing on the turnaround strategy at SAR. And what we're saying now is that SAA reported losses of 883. I take it that's in the previous year. Am I right?
Yeah.
In the previous year, and will report a break even this year, in the current year. Now, that is directly attributed to the turnaround strategy. However, there was this, am I correct, that because of the huge fluctuation upwards of the oil price, you then have a negative showing this. And precisely what that is so good to count. Or do we have the figures? Did you say what the figure was?
Yeah, I've said a figure of 123 before the restructuring, for 7 and after restructuring, 1.31.
What does that mean? I mean, this year, what is the position? Is SAA making a loss this year of 1.3? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
1.3 billion.
Yeah.
And this is directly attributable to the oil.
No, that is after, if it's before restructuring, then they're making a side profit of 123 million.
So
after
then you're factoring in the
restructuring
cost.
Yeah.
Okay. Then, SAA wants to recapitalize, right? And they need to recapitalize, if they try to understand. Now, explain that to me. Firstly, what exactly are we recapitalizing on? Is it, for example, the fleet? And if so, then explain to me as a layperson, because this is a question that I'm asking, I can't explain. If we are going to be purchasing aircraft, which I imagine that's what the capitalization is meant to do, and we have grounded aircraft, why is it that we do that? Are we buying new stuff? Is it going to be more profitable? Why do we need to expand in such a manner? And then we can talk about the actual funding issues, which is your guarantee as opposed to the capital injection. It seems to me that the interest on whatever loan that is underwritten by Treasury is just phenomenal, and it doesn't make any sense for anybody to borrow under those terms, regardless of a guarantee, because a guarantee doesn't, as I understand it, lower your borrowing rate. So that's the one big kind of area that I want you to speak to. The second issue is, look, I wasn't here, and I haven't got a clue why it is. I know that SAA was broadly part of Transnet. And then we took SAA and Transnet and pulled them apart. And then we took South African Express out of SAA. And I imagine that was done for whatever corporate governance issues. Maybe we couldn't, maybe it was so opaque in the corporate environment that we didn't know who was doing what and which part was more profitable. I don't know how that works. But now we've got a situation where you've got South African Express and you've got SAA, and it almost seems that the areas of contestation there. And I'm just wondering whether that's the best case scenario, whether we shouldn't be considering amalgamating SAA and SA Express back into some kind of SOE that we had before, the kind of teasing up. And then explain to me the I'm very keen on this issue of the strategic overview of state involvement in airline systems, because I do think that from where, and I get what you guys are saying, but I'm saying not everybody does. I mean, not everybody that you speak to will immediately jump to the conclusion that it is absolutely strategically important for this country to have an airline. Not everybody has that view. Why? Because not everybody understands the global terrain that SAA operates in. For example, I mean, one of the key drawings that will always remain in my head is when we were at the Austin School and we saw this kind of star thing going out from, I think it was Dubai, into the rest of the world. And then you suddenly realize, oh my goodness, where are we? You know, we don't feature there. Now that star thing, the star effect, so to speak, is something that we need to start influencing in people's minds. Say that, look, you know, do we judge an SAA merely by the profits and losses of it? What are the spin-offs of an SAA? And I really think that if there's one document that the department needs to comply, it's that issue, the strategic importance of this country, of SAA to the country. Because I think we must start valuing the cost to the economy without an SAA. And I think really that's the kind of document that I think we need to get from you, so that we can start projecting SAA as more than just an entity that is losing money, because actually the value derived from SAA is far exceeds the profits and losses in terms of monetary value. So I think we need that kind of exercise. I'm sure you would have done that, and that's readily available and so on. And I think that you need to let us have something of that sort, so that as members of Parliament, we can then start maybe even distributing that kind of strategic document to other colleagues who have some constituencies who would then report back and so on. Because constantly what you get in the media is this type of a terribly run SAA that just sucks up money and it's a black hole basically from which nothing good ever comes up. In terms of book and market book, both SAA and SA Express came from Transnet. The reason why we took out the aviation portfolio from Transnet is that because they're in such a volatile market, they were actually having quite a significant impact on Transnet and causing quite a degree of volatility on Transnet's financial performance. So the removal of SAA and SA Express, the aviation portfolio from Transnet, has just meant that Transnet has got a much more stable portfolio going forward and enabled Transnet's policy to lend, frankly. Now, SAA Express has been left in Transnet for some time. However, over the years, SAA Express, from a very difficult base, has been able to turn itself around, but still is an undercapitalized entity. And one of the great things with the transaction is that when we closed the transaction with Transnet, we paid for the assets to Transnet, but we also capitalized SA Express. So SA Express would be a strong standalone airline. Now, in the long-term ideal portfolio strategy is to have a holding company, an aviation holding company, which has a long-range full-service carrier, that is what is traditionally right now called SAA, and then the other, which is a regional service provider, and that is what the case with the Express. And that will evolve over time. But in the meantime, what you don't want to do is put either company at risk because of either operating conditions
that they come to us. We appoint to the IATA, in fact, the IATA is more than, because the appointment of the consultant was a part of the thing. The real issue is that we were buying the database from them, and I must say, Chairperson, if I may, it's just really unfortunate that the DVD responsible for that is not here. Because whenever I say to people, think about the English that you use, edit the documentation, edit the annual report, it's like I'm going on like a mad woman. So quite beautiful that a lot of people have heard this directly from me as well. Is that IATA was not appointed to advise us necessarily, but to give us, because they have the global database of what moves, because we needed all of that data to be able to then make a very firm argument. Because the two markets that we were particularly interested in was looking at what happened to Brazil after Varig went down, because that would be the basis of an objective analysis of what the Brazilian economy faced. Now, bearing in mind that Brazil is a bigger country than us, it's a bigger economy, frankly, but really we don't have it. And so as a tourist area, with Varig going down, we knew that other carriers would still continue to fly it. But it's been quite interesting to also look at the economic effects, because that's the economic effect, which is not about how many people come to your country, but it's how much revenue you as a country retain when you don't own a major airline. And that's the part of the argument. So we've got that data now, and I think we should be soon be able to come back and give an assessment, just based on the country that all of us know that went down. And also to look at ANZ, ANZ is the Air New Zealand, in New Zealand, which was privatized incidentally. It went bust, was almost going bust, the government renationalized it and acquired 80% of the company, and that most people don't talk about. And New Zealand in exactly the same position that we are in, where we are also an end-of-the-sphere carrier. If you're an end-of-the-sphere, and the most exciting thing that you have is Johannesburg and Cape Town from tourism and the course of season, you then run the risk of air services which go when it's off-season in Europe, and so Europeans want to come to South Africa, and shrink when it's season in Europe and Europeans are not interested in coming to South Africa. The risk to an economy of having an air service of that nature are too large to imagine, but that we can come back on. The capitalization, in fact, Chair, which we were asking for FAM, and I suppose the interest to get in the fund, it's not so much about the acquisition of new aircraft. I mean, any airline requires those going forward. But on the one was about dealing with the PDPs. The PDPs were the people that you pay, are the delivery payments, which are for the Airbus contract, and that's been in the paper for some time, which was introduced in 2002, which were not cancelled effectively. And so technically, we owe that money. We have to pay. The other is the replacement of the guarantees. Now, guarantees is a paper, literally, and conditions that says that I guarantee that SAA effectively has 1.56 billion at the state, but the guarantee comes at a cost because guarantees have a fee attached to it. And then SAA takes the guarantee, and in this, they then go into the market and they will raise the cash sometimes. And sometimes it's not necessarily that they need the cash into the company. Is this a guarantee? In the case of the 1.96, it's a guarantee for the Boeing 747, which they will now. Now, why they have gone the 747 is that the 747, the lease is extremely expensive, but also the operating cost of the 747 was so high, they're actually cheaper to ground than to fly. And so, literally, that's the simple, that's why we have grounded them. There were six of them. The agreement was that they would find the steps. I think 57. I may get the numbers slightly wrong. So what we had agreed with SAA is that they would find mechanisms of disposing of the rest of them or whatever. But and four of them have been prudently disposed of. And the proposal is on leasing to other companies until the lease comes to an end. So we're sitting, I think, with two of the 747s that we have. And then the market conditions on the one hand. And also with the price of fuel going very high, the 747s have become very expensive because they are quite significant levels of fuel. So I think that's really what we... And then the last element is around a change in accounting rules standards for frequent flyer programs, which now has to be accounted for. Previously, for that we're waiting to see what the final ruling would be. On something like frequent flyer programs, it's not a problem for us, of course, SAA only. It's a problem for every single long distance full service carrier on the frequent flyer program. And whatever the outcome that comes out, its impact is going to be quite dramatic on virtually all of the
areas. Well, what that means really is that the balance sheet then looks much weaker, and then it affects the standing in terms of borrowing. So, can I just get this clear one thing? This capital injection that they require, which is what they're going to now roll out into the market to borrow, is actually for things like the leases that they have to pay, and for what else did you say? It's the
delivery payment for the acquisition of the Airbuses. And we have to see if we
we're acquiring Airbuses, is that what it's saying? Which currently hopefully are cheaper to run.
Yeah.
I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
I mean, I just travel by SAA and I just hope for the best kind of thing. Okay? So, Airbuses are cheaper to run than Salesforce. That one I can take as a hit.
Yes, it's a two dimensions to the question. So that's why they are cheaper than the 747s, but more importantly than even that, they are more suited to our market in terms of prices. But remember, the Airbuses that we're talking about is the Airbuses that would replace the Boeing 737, the one that fly down within Cape Town, because those leases start to come to an end around to the same going forward. So that was what.
So we really need the Airbus, is what it says.
Basically,
you know,
I'm
not
going to say. Yeah, no, we've been saying that. But I mean,
really need the Airbus. So you have to pay for that. Yeah, which is your pre-delivery
thing,
and that's part of the 1.56.
No, the 1.56 is the guarantee that was just
in its entirety.
Yeah, was just for the 747. Now, the replacement of the guarantee, because we pay guarantee fees, and when we have a guarantee and we're going to the market, we also pay interest rates. We were proposing the replacement of guarantee with straight equity. So that's the other one. And then the other was then these accounting standards around frequent flyer.
How long are we still going to pay off these things around now?
I can't remember sharing because it would be the duration of the lease at the point at which we have to send back our obligations are finished. So whatever's left of the lease is our responsibility to deal with.
And then you just say it's four of them they're trying to get
No, they have. Okay. So four are dealt with. We're left with two only that we can't find a solution.
And when you say four have been dealt with over the full duration of that, we're not sorry breaking even. We might have even done it at a discount or whatever, but I mean, at least it's not possible.
I think
so.
Okay. The people who have got to the ground, that's going for 7. The appreciation and depreciation situation is not applying to
them. I'm not an accountant, so I'll expect the accountant, but it doesn't belong to us, it's the lease. It's not our agent.
So we're going to get the document, right? We're going to get that document about the strategic importance. And then what I want in that document specifically is for there to be a cost analysis of the kind of financial problems we currently have and how the restructuring has actually alleviated some of that stuff. Because it has, I mean, without the restructuring, there'd probably be a worse situation than currently. So that's the first cost thing, right? The second cost thing is the value of SAA strategically to the country and the kind of actuarial kind of figures that it puts to the market, so called strategic market. So, you know, what is the value?
grand consent almost, how important it is.
The strategic overview has been completed. Okay, that has been completed. And the role of it in cargo operations, the long haul flight, the full freight operation has been terminated. And ISA is now focusing on daily flights of long haul aircraft, but not like dedicated aircraft for full freight. The alignment between ISA and SAC and the government interest is the African regulations that have been developed. And the government imperative is that ISA should be a viable and a sustainable business. And the restructuring program is running until March 2009 to make it sustainable. And ISA is still the largest conveyor for the tourist collection. The supply development plan for Transnet and Eskom were completed by March last year, and those documents are now available on DP's website. Some other work was done in support of Eskom Transnet to deliver the supply development plan. In terms of procurement capacity building, a number of procurement boot camps were held within both SOE as well and Transnet have actually formalized a web-based procurement training for their procurement staff. Now, supporting the implementation of the CSDP, a supply benchmarking program has been developed and has been implemented with UNIDO. So that process is ongoing. In addition to the CSDP, the South African Power Project was implemented, which is looking at sort of beyond the scope of the CSDP, which is trying to localize as much as possible the build program. But the South African Power Project is really looking at a much bigger industrialization opportunity associated with the build program. And that strategy was developed and accepted by Cabinet in February this year. And at the moment, we're just sorting off the mechanism for overseeing the implementation of that program. With regards to the skills development change, you've already asked about the ESA, and I think the one line we can give today about the ESA is that its role is to facilitate the placement of SET graduates within ESCOM Transnet and their suppliers. So that's effectively what the ESA is doing and has been approved for that. And the process this year now is engaging with ESCOM Transnet and PBMR and their suppliers to fulfill that objective. With regards to the property project, after the lifting of the moratorium last year, the guidelines were produced and aligned to the DCI code, and these are made available on the website. And the number of transactions as listed were concluded, namely the AXA Denard, SA AXA, Transit Servicon were conceded. In support of other ongoing property transactions, specifically with ESCOM, some valuations were undertaken to ensure value optimization. In terms of the rest of Africa, that initially the project was conceptualized to contribute to the development of infrastructure projects across the continent. And to this end, we've identified various stakeholders in our neighboring countries.
and their ongoing discussions with those stakeholders. Following on and borrowing from our experience in South Africa with the CSDC program, we've also approached other African countries to implement a joint supply development program. And what we've done for that department with UNIDA, again, to implement the best supplier benchmarking and development program. And that program will actually be formally launched this coming weekend in Durban at the African Investment Promotion Agency Network Forum. And we'll also be discussed at a CEO forum on Monday, Tuesday next week. With regards to our ICT program, significant progress was made in identifying potential clients for our call center project. However, towards the end, the initial design or source of capital for the project didn't materialize. So as of March last year, we're in the process of revisiting the funding model for that project. However, unfortunately, at this stage, we've decided that as DTE will no longer continue with this project. But it's also given that DTI have already come up with an incentive scheme for call centers, which incorporates the bulk of our objective, of our initial objective as DTE. In terms of environmental issues, we've been working closely with DS to define guidelines as a process for EIA for strategically important development. These sites have been identified, and as of March this year, DS had a test but had bought into the SIS process, and I can report that as of September this year, we've actually completed the SIS guidelines. In terms of NECA legislation, recommendations were made to DS and DME, and also in terms of just assisting DS to have the capacity to timely process the various EIAs from SOE. The SOEs have been contributing to an SOE fund to assist DS. And this fund from this SOE fund is also being used to develop sector guidelines, which will stipulate standards and laws to be used to approve various applications. The first guideline will just be implemented in terms of an MOU between DS and DTE.
and if you can't, one of the things that we need to ensure is that we've got this wonderful build program that's going to get us out of our crisis. And some people don't understand that in 2012 we're back to the situation. And if we, through our, frankly, lackluster performance in government, are to avoid a similar crisis because of our lackluster, so we create this crisis and timelines and all the wonky on it. We need trust. And somebody has to raise the alarm now. I mean, one of the lessons that we have to learn from this ESCOM debacle is that if we don't act timely, we're going to face problems. And, you know, I think it's, and I know that it's a problem when you have raised it, people don't listen, and so on, so on. But clearly one of the lessons we have to learn as government is that you have to do more than merely persuasion and then try and just step back. So I think that if you're going to be a Rottweiler, this is your opportunity to do so. And particularly given the fact that you have a new minister, I think a report should be given to her to table as cabinet as soon as possible. And you can say that it's a recommendation that we've made to you from the portfolio to try and re-raise some of these issues, but to do it in such a way that we can understand the timeline and how important they are. Because if you start having two different forums at which you have to get approval, you're doubling the time. I mean, just, you know? And as efficient as everybody may be, it's still going to stretch out those things. I don't know what other countries do, but we have a particular situation on our hands. It may be that in the ordinary course of nuclear build, whatever, that's fine. But we are in crisis, and that we should start treating it as a crisis, not to say we're in a crisis and do nothing about it.
I mean, I wouldn't agree with you more. To be honest, this is one of those areas where having a planning commission will be absolutely invaluable. Because at least when you go to the planning, when you go to whoever's the head of the planning commission and you raise this matter, which is insufficient in terms of how the system is arranged, you at least have an objective arbiter in the discussion who would be able to come back with the final decision, having taken consideration to the point where. Because one of the issues that we also raised is the question is, given the fact that NEMA places an obligation on the officials of these, whoever the accountable persons are, to do environmental assessments, and the ex-DME puts the same obligations, the question that we've often asked is, in terms of law, this MOU and you taking somebody else's word, is that sufficient to cover you with the responsibility to ensure that you've actually applied your mind to the question? Is it not a much more efficient to assign the responsibility in a proper fashion?
It just seems to me that in a crisis situation such as trying to have trouble, extraordinary measures should be taken. As I say, I don't expect that, assuming they don't want legislation as it is, but then let us see what the terms and conditions of those MOUs are in terms of time frames. Are we now saying, okay, we'll do our job, you do your job, and we'll just agree that we do it well. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, that's not good enough in a crisis situation, particularly as you've got projections going forward.
Mm-hmm.
And you're meant to have that kilowatt that's coming on stream when you say it's going to be on stream because your demand is hello, it's
mm-hmm.
going on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, I really think, you see, that I know it's difficult to re-raise issues and try and fight battles that are really losing battles and so on. But if there was I would call it a dereliction of duty if people don't do it. Just to deal with this crisis that we have, I think that special arrangements need to be made. I'm not even going to say what those arrangements should be. All I'm saying is that the timelines are absolutely crucial. Not wanting to compromise on safety and environmental things, you know, without trying to negate those issues. They're absolutely important issues. Nuclear safety is absolutely important, which is why we need to start gearing ourselves up now and not have problems down the line. I mean, I'll tell you a horrible
now wanting to build schools for South Africa where they teach math and science, out in Gauteng, which is supposed to be a more kind of efficient where EIA takes something upward of 2 to 3 years to get done. I mean, it's a nightmare. And if we can't get that right at the level of township development, I don't even know. I don't think we've ever done the scale of nuclear development before. So how on earth do we expect that through an MOU we're going to sort out all of life's problems? So please do raise it very softly with the minister and do what you can to ensure that you convey to her our absolute
first one was really around aerostructures, where again we're just looking to leverage current aerostructure initiatives to build an aerostructure industry. The key achievement there was around the now where the technology review gets a focus on the way to fuselage bearing. And this was allowed us now to enter into a proposal with Embraer.
Now we know exactly what you mean when you say stuff like that.
I'll have to hazard a guess. It's really the structure was to support the wing going off and the fuselage is sort of the narrow, the long tube in the middle of the plane. So the structures and support around that would just hold everything together in this simplistic term.
So
it holds everything together, very simple saying, the framework and all the steelwork which will support all the metal plates which you'll see on top of the aircraft.
So that's exactly what we understood
by the institute for us. Exactly. And by the composite parts, really, these are not naturally occurring materials like metals or so forth. But it's a special material with extra strength, which have a very low strength to weight ratio. So they're lighter than your normal steel material, than aluminium, but they'll actually give you greater strength. So they're not just saying that's a capability we're trying to build in South Africa. And then we have also approached the NAR with an interest for the NAR doing work for them. In terms of a minor project with Belarus, where the aim was to identify areas of cooperation with Belarus, specifically in the space of defense, or that as trips were undertaken to Belly Reef and those opportunities which we were interested in as South Africa were identified. But unfortunately, having notified the Belarusians of our areas of interest, there wasn't any feedback from them. So that project was put on hold, and during the course of this year, we've actually decided to suspend that project.
Was there one of the formal stages of that project was to have a
the neighbor to Ukraine, the southern part of Belarus, actually suffered from when they had the nuclear accident. And it's not very far from Chernobyl. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, and then they have to go absolutely.
So what kind of market
in the funny, I think it's really unfortunate that we weren't able to get further away. Because they're the interesting other to us. The similarities are in the Russian, as far as the situation. This was almost like the place where they put a lot of money and they did R&D, a lot more R&D work was done in Belarus. And in the Ukraine, that's where you had the heavy, large manufacturing. They had a manufacturing base as well. So there's quite a lot of investment in design, manufacturing. Quite a lot of really high-end technical skills that they have in their population. When you walk around their factories, you have pretty much some of the situations like deja vu of walking around the now plant where you have all the antiquated machinery. But like South Africans, they were picking it up and they were producing some previously world-class products the machinery that we have. They have. The real divide between us and them of language, and if we had been able to bring the issue of language, in my opinion, from country to country, they would have been absolutely amazing strategic partners. They don't have money, but they have amazing capabilities that they took a limit, but specifically the government has chosen to say more Russian amounts than European amounts. So I just think both the issue of funding and frankly, we wouldn't have I think it just became a little bit more difficult. But as a country, really, with a little bit of money, that country would be keen to use that.
The last KKF project we report on was really just a short piece of work around the technology and innovation framework to guide R&D strategy within our SOEs. This framework was developed and accepted by our minister and been presented to our SOEs, and it was actually applied by the NAL staff to realign their strategy and this.
In the annual appropriation from 2.9 in 2006-07 to 4.6 in 2007-08, which was mainly as a result of the increased transfer payments, which included grants to state-owned enterprises. And that is illustrated in each one of the table to follow in terms of where the funding was allocated. Understanding was 1.1 million. It was made up of 74,000 in our operational budget, and the balance was 1.031 in respect to funds earmarked for the NALSARP indemnity, which was granted, and the final audited amount of the claim was less than the funds originally allocated. We did did an assessment of what they thought it was going to be, but you can never be exactly sure. So we didn't draw those funds. We achieved our expenditure well within the 2% benchmark. And the final note here is that expenditure disbursed from what is classified as local and foreign aid funds, which was the original funding for the joint project facility that was given to us in 2005-06 by the SOE before the FISC has funded the joint project facility. We've been utilizing that after negotiations with Treasury for contracts that were signed originally against that funding, and therefore it did affect something on our financial performance where a deficit of 942,000 was actually reflected, but it was as a result of these funds there. So we thought it would be useful for you to actually have that in the departmental trends explanation. We go on to the business unit, program one, which has gone up quite considerably from 50.7 million. Do you need me to run through what administration is doing?
Yeah, I think you're going to just point to the big sheet.
Okay, all right. We went up quite significantly from 2007, from 50.7 million to 66.3 million. And this increase was due to the centralization of maintenance and a whole lot of other. We tried to take away operational things from the business units and left them as core, and we centralized that. It's also a better way of controlling the expenditure in those kind of things. Another very big expense that came up was the rooftop celebration and the energy saving project within the department. So this is one of the indications. So that was one of those are the sort of factors that caused that program to increase at that stage. Program two, the expenditure for this program was 86 million compared to the 725.3 in 2006-07. It was due to the decrease in the transfer payments to the SOE. Operational expenditure increased slightly due to the participation in the National Energy Saving Campaign and the SA Power Plant. The cost of this was shared with the communications unit. expenditure for Program 3 amounted to 21.1 compared to 16.5 in 2006-07. That increase was mainly due to the legal costs incurred as a result of Alex for Rooster land plans, as well as certain specialist services applied for the drafting of the Infocrone tax bill. Program 4 was also increased to 3.7 billion compared to the 1.8 billion in 2006-07, and that was also due to an increase in transfer payments to the SOE, and I think that is what NOAA and also PBMR. Program 5, the expenditure amounted to 752.1 million compared to 3.5 million in 2006-07. and that is due to the transfer payment of 744.4 million to SAA. That amount included bank chair to SAA. The joint project facility increased from 11.4 in 2006-07 to 15.5 in 2007-08, and that was due to an increase in existing projects as well as the sourcing of specialist and technical expertise required to meet some of the objectives in the union. I've also prepared a schedule and an explanation on the environment. Would you like me to run through those for you, or how would you like me to deal with that?
And the environment basically transfer from one program to another.
Yes.
The only thing that I'd like you to explain to me is the ones in brackets, those are from MLA.
Yes.
So 946 would be taken away from program 3 and put to where?
Okay, that's where we would have to go. You see, sometimes it's a consolidated amount that we have put to different programs,
exactly.
And that is why we've
so
done the
what
explanation.
What I'm trying to establish is those things in brackets, if I add them up, if I add those things not in brackets, I should get the same amount.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the detail is in
that
chart. Okay.
Well, that's
And the departmental revenue, we've done a table together with an explanation of each income there. Normally, admin fees, parking, 2.1 was admin fees, parking, and commission on insurance, 2.2 interest received on debt, 2.3 income from sale of redundant furniture in previous year, and 2.4 is other receipts, including recoverable revenue, which is lost active card bursary payments in previous year, transfer to debt account in current year.
What is the
I think, and I'm talking about correction here, if we allow Old Mutual to debit directly to the account of the a direct debit to my account, if I'm paying something on insurance or retirement annuity or something, they pay the department a certain percentage. It's very small, but they do. It's very nice for the administration because then they don't have to worry about it going from person's bank account and things like that. So I think it applies to our government. So it assists them tremendously. Also based on last year, I thought it would be useful on the major expenditure items to give you a breakdown. There are comparative figures on the calculation, but these are the major expenditure items and giving you the breakdown of what they were made up of. I can give you more, we can go to the income statement if you wish. Compensation of employees, again, I thought it would be very useful for you to see how that was made up over the 2 years, even just for the current year, and what each figure illustrates besides the basic salary, which is self-explanatory. Performance awards, I've actually written out so that you would know exactly what each item was for, taken from the annual financial statement. I think, and that is quite self-explanatory. I hope I've addressed the stuff that you would think.
That is phenomenal.
Thank you. Now, I must say, it's the first time that I've seen the finances of the company get up so legit.
Chair, this is sort of partly for the sensitivity. We've been able to put the block within the past, but on the board.
some of the emerging risks and the challenges. And some of the challenges that we face going forward as a department. I mean, at the time, one of the biggest has been the question of institutional continuity. The emerging risk at the end of the year became a real stress for, frankly, most of this year. It's a question of whether GPE will continue going forward. And so it did create some serious tensions around, you know, the people starting in the jobs rooms. And given the amount of energy and effort that has gone into developing systems in GPE, this is really, has been an area of great concern for us. The other is the continuing challenge of getting appropriately skilled people who have the special skills that we require. And, you know, the constant challenges, in truth, because we review the stuff that is done by some seriously experienced people, and you've met the CFOs of the enterprises and the rest of your life, and we have to do a review. So the question of being able to access deep skills and deep experience will remain a challenge until we are able to find a comfortable medium between the salaries that we pay and the demands and the kind of people that we're looking for in the department as well. I've already indicated this question of uncertainty around the continued existence of the department. Which is, I suppose, a forever thing that we have to live with, is managing the tensions that exist between the issue holder, worrying about commercial interests on the one hand, as well as the flexibility and agility of the state system to respond as quickly as possible to questions that arise from a federal questions around recapitalization of FOE. And our view is that if we don't find a quicker way of securing funding for state-owned enterprises or of getting responses out of government quickly so government can access a rational shareholder, the value that you have or the ability to leverage the assets that you have will always be placed under significant pressure. This question of funding SOE is a big problem, and for us we think requires a lot of details today. And in part is in collected is already in the report that we wrote around how you some proposals around how you could capitalize state owned enterprises. The current situation that we have is you're going to put in a business plan and you want to fund the undersea cable in proposing to make strong arguments in terms of its economic effect. And the response that you get is that the fund was held by the vaccine. Now obviously the vaccine has to work. However, the state owns the vaccine. So it does put us in a little bit of a seriously difficult position. So what we've been trying is understanding what other countries do, so that there's an effective separation between general government expenditure and government investment decisions, because the money is in state-owned enterprise is an investment. It can't be treated as expenditure going in. So it remains a source of challenge, and we think it's an area that must be resolved at the very worst in the next administration. It must be resolved if you are serious about saying the SOE can be used to leverage other developmental opportunities for the state. And the last one, which is the deep worry, it's a deep worry not only in ESCOM actually, but it's a deep worry even in Transnet, is the revenue generation capability of the SOE. It is under threat. And especially with all of the SOEs having these very strong growth programs, ensuring that the regulatory environment and the tariffing environment bears in mind that and finds a way to balance the requirements for ensuring that the SOEs earn enough to be able to continue with the growth program going forward on the one hand, but also ensuring that the SOEs are efficient as well, because we are conscious of the fact that you also don't want to have a system that is so assuring of returns for the SOE that the incentive or the tension for them to be efficient is taken away. However, the argument that we try to make is if you find yourself in a situation where the SOE is not making enough of the return, the board has a fiduciary responsibility to stop the investment program. If you stop the investment program, you have a stop start to your economy. and whatever possibility for leverage is wiped out, whatever opportunity that the investment will generate for generate for growth is taken away. But that's not your biggest problem. Your biggest problem is that you just create a massive infrastructure backlog in your bottleneck in your economy, that you actually literally have to cool down the economy until you are able to fund again a growth program going forward. So for us, really, really massive risk if we don't ensure that regulators make decisions that are correct. Because you may, in an environment where you have inflation targets, and they normally agree that you have to make sure that prices are contained, because actually containment of prices does help improve profitability to companies. But it cannot be at the cost of the enterprise providing the service. It's a question of sustainability. If coal inflation is 28%, but your target band is 3-6%, it doesn't take away the fact that literally prices of coal are increasing at that rate. The same problem with capital goods, and the capital goods inflation affects not only Eskom, it affects Transnet in exactly the same fashion. If it is 20-25% is the number we're getting, it is that number. And so the tariff you can't force the tariff to behave as if inflation in those activities and in those sectors was behaving. So an area that we will be approaching Cameron soon is the valuation methodology for assets and also issues around indexation of the assets, so that going forward, the SOEs are making adequate allocations via the depreciation allowance for investments into the future. So these are, I think, you know, just operationally are the big risks and the big challenges that we believe we have to manage if the state is going to be able to leverage the ownership of the assets. Chair, that's the end of our presentation.
Thank you, DJ. And I'm sure that my members would agree with me that this is one of the nicest presentations we've received from the top. And not that this subject is to me, under my chairmanship, but certainly I got the feeling, and I hope you did too, which is a particularly interesting discussion. Hopefully, you would have had a perspective that. That emanates from our side in terms of some of our political objectives and priorities and really solid strategies. And I'm saying study group because they are on the ANC energy, unfortunately. I imagine the opposition party participants. So thank you very much to each and every one of you. In a very useful morning, certainly from our perspective. We take note of some of your challenges. Not anything new to us, I don't think, as members. Something we have been made aware of constantly. Please, again, let me reiterate to you, DG, and through you, our availability to support you in initiatives and in some of the big fights and so on. We are here to oversee you, but it's always been our philosophy that ultimately the end game is to do what is right for the people of this country and for the economy as a whole. And so where there are those synergies, we will help you, and we will try and champion whatever arguments we can see from the focus, while of course maintaining quite the vigilant stance on some issues, particularly okay. So thank you all for your indulgence. It is now past 1:20. I take it that what we're gonna do, members, is we were meant to reconvene at 3:00. I'm going to suggest, if it's okay with you, that we convene tomorrow to deal with those outstanding reports. Remember, we've got reports from our visits to the various places which we need to process, some of which we've halfway processed. We've made some amendments and so on. So it's really a question of just adopting them with whatever changes we had asked Llewellyn to start with. I think that is essentially Alex Co and Sarko. So we shouldn't be too long tomorrow. And then there's an outstanding one on Transnet that we're so busy with. So that one may take a while tomorrow. But whatever the case is, I'm sure we'll be able to process all of them tomorrow. We meet at 10:53 now.
No, I don't know.